You're listening to The Quarterdeck with Benjamin Strong and Coast Guard Admiral Jim Watson.
Hi, it's Ben Strong from Amver.com, and welcome to the August edition of Quarterdeck. I'm happy to say that my co-host Admiral Watson is back and in his new position at Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Admiral.
Hi, Ben. It's good to be back. I am in Washington, D.C. I made the journey up from Portsmouth, Virginia, and it's actually the third or fourth time I've probably been in Coast Guard headquarters since I was a lieutenant junior grade.
There you go.
But I grew up closer to this area than I did down in Portsmouth, Virginia, so I feel a little bit at home.
Well, that's good. Well, welcome home to you. And we can kind of jokingly call this our earthquake edition because we were going to try to connect yesterday, but the kind of that Virginia, Washington, D.C. earthquake put the kibosh on that. So we're back and we're ready to go, aren't we?
We are ready to go. Yeah, that was a little bit unusual here. I'd been in California in my career and was prepared when I was out there, but it was a bit unusual getting shook up in Coast Guard headquarters. But we're all back to normal today.
We are, and it's been a busy month for both of us. Amver's had a busy month. We've had a couple of rescues that I'd like to share. Really dramatic, and it demonstrates it really shows the effort that our Amver crews will go through in order to save lives. And the first was the first that I want to share was July 27th. It took place about 780 miles northeast of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. So, you know, I mean, we joke and we talk about these cases, but again, this is another example of where there are sailors essentially in the middle of nowhere that ended up in harm's way, and we had a ship that was able to rescue them. This crew, these two sailors on a sailboat, activated their EPIRB, and they sent a distress call to the Rescue Coordination Center in Boston, stating that their sails were torn, their engines were disabled, and they were taking on water. And really, about the only resources available that far out were Amver resources, and our shipmates up in Boston quickly queried the Amver system and found a tanker, the motor vessel Kim Jacob, that was able to divert and assist these sailors. Now, what's really interesting is the case was complicated by both the size of the ship, which was over 600 feet long, and the weather conditions with winds at 30 knots and seas were between 8 and 12 feet. And the sailboat had a sea anchor deployed. So as this tanker came alongside the ship, it somehow snagged the sea anchor and started to drag the sailboat amidships, and it was really a complicated rescue. There were two people on board, Admiral. The woman was able to get aboard climbing up a Jacob's ladder, but the male, her companion who was sailing with her, ended up being thrown overboard. And, you know, this really speaks to the seamanship and the skill of these crews and masters. That ship stayed on station and searched for an additional 3 hours, was able to locate that survivor in the water, and then was able to hoist him aboard. But I also think it demonstrates that there are some significant challenges for our commercial mariners when they're forced you know, when they encounter these kind of search and rescue cases. I mean, it's just the challenges that they face are amazing.
Absolutely. That was a great case. The seamanship of our professional maritime worldwide is just incredible. And I know we ask a lot when we make these calls to the Amver participants, but it's just truly amazing how quite often successful they are. And it's so fortunate for those two sailors.
Oh, I mean, it was just an amazing case, and I know my colleagues in the Office of Search and Rescue at Coast Guard Headquarters are looking at the actual difficulty of rescuing people at sea, and they're working through the IMO to either investigate if there's some standardized equipment or standardized procedures, or if the International Search and Rescue Manual needs to be updated. So, you know, it's important for the sailing community that may be listening to this, and to the commercial community that listens to this, that, you know, we do look at these cases, we do survivor debriefings, and we review how can things be done better. So hopefully a case like this will be able to yield some results and make, you know, searching and rescuing better for survivors and the yachting and maritime community, and for the folks that we call on to do the rescuing. But the case is almost repeated down in down near the Dominican Republic, when the Clipper Glory, which is another AMVIR participant, noticed flares that were being shot up, and there were two additional sailors that had to be taken off their boat after the you know, and this is something that perhaps folks don't realize, but it was a young gal and her father were sailing, and the father developed a medical problem. And despite the blood pressure medicine and things that he had, the young gal and her father, you know, had to be medically evacuated off their boat. So this Hong Kong flagship was able to, you know, was able to embark the two sailors, and they were taken on to the next port of call. But I'm sure very scary for the sailors, and I'm thankful that our AMVIR participants, working with our flight surgeons and rescue coordinators, were able to provide the kind of medical attention and safety that they required. But anything can happen at sea, can't it, Admiral?
It sure can, and in my current job, I'm really focused on the prevention side of this, and I guess I, in a way, have been involved in that my whole career. So it's actually with a great amount of pride and high expectations that I come to this new job from the old job, which was really more focused on the response. And of course, I was paying very close attention on a day-to-day basis on the AMVIR rescues and the Coast Guard's rescues and all of the other things that we do as a service for the maritime at large, whether it's safety, security, or environmental response. But I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we're doing here in the prevention side of the Coast Guard's mission set.
You know, I think that's interesting, and you're really in an area now where you're going to be touching mariners from the prevention side and affecting what they do. So please tell us the initiatives and some of the things you're working on, Admiral.
Sure. Well, you know, your two cases did involve yachts, and one of the things in my list of activities here is outreach with the recreational boating community, with the yachting community. The Coast Guard, of course, is responsible for providing standards for life-saving equipment, for signaling equipment such as the flares and the EPIRBs. And more recently, we've really tried to work with our partners, the Coast Guard Auxiliary, the auxiliary squadrons, yacht clubs, boating associations, to have as much education as we can. And this is where I think we can bridge the gap between what the professional mariners are capable of doing and how to interact with them in an emergency, and with the expectations that really we should have on yachtsmen and recreational boaters that are going out on the high seas. So I'm excited to be working back with the boating safety folks here at Coast Guard headquarters. And one of the things that we remarked on is the 10th anniversary of the boating safety law that was passed in 1971. Mm-hmm. And we've literally cut the number of deaths in recreational boating in half over those years, at the same time that the numbers of recreational boats and the numbers of people that are recreating on boats has doubled. Wow. So in effect, we've reduced it by one quarter in real terms. And so we're very proud of that, but there's still about over 700 people a year, unfortunately, who die in recreational boating accidents, and we're striving to find ways to reduce that number.
Well, and it's you know, you read about cases where somebody dies in some kind of boating accident, and I know that domestically, at least here in the United States, you know, a lot of the command message is either drinking and boating, or not having a PFD, a life preserver, on some kind of life jacket. And I know at least our public affairs people here in the Coast Guard are working very, very hard to communicate with the, you know, to let the boating community know you have to wear a life jacket and you shouldn't be drinking and boating. So whatever you're doing at headquarters, sir, I know the message is being passed along here, and I hope if we have recreational boaters that are listening that you're wearing your life jacket, you're not drinking and boating, and I would add that you've got an EPIRB that's properly registered, because those are the things that'll save your life. We've demonstrated we can get amber ships or other Coast Guard resources to people. They just have to be, you know, floating, and we have to know where to go to get them.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, there's also a couple of important changes in the works that will have impact on professional mariners. And moving on to those, there's a series of public meetings going on with regard to a notice of proposed rulemaking regarding the standards for training and watchkeeping. And this is something that will affect the licensing standards for U.S. merchant mariners, but it really stems from the international convention changes that the United States is simply a party to and implementing domestically. And some of these standards are coming into effect. I think most of them are coming into effect this January for the world's mariners, and that will, I think, ratchet up the professionalism of merchant mariners worldwide another notch. They've come such a long way in the last several decades that it's just incredible to see how professional and how this industry has changed over that period of time. So we're happy to do our part in making that happen here in the United States. A second rulemaking that is primarily domestic here, but is very significant both to the Coast Guard and to the industry here, is the Coast Guard has announced that it has plans to inspect what's currently uninspected towing vessels. And so those notice of proposed rulemaking of last month, and that will affect some 7,000 vessels in the United States, maybe 5,000 to 7,000. We're still not exactly sure. Our current number of inspected vessels is about 10,000. Mm-hmm. So that's a significant bump up for the Coast Guard and for the maritime industry. And, of course, towing vessels come in all shapes and sizes. You have a lot of towing vessels that just work the inland waterways or the ports and harbors. But you also have a lot of towing vessels that are already on international voyages. They already meet the SOLAS requirements, but they will in the future have a Coast Guard certificate of inspection on them.
So does this include vessels even down to like a towboat USA size, like say maybe a 20-foot vessel?
Yes, it depends on what their service is.
Okay.
But if it's a commercial towing vessel, and I think it may have a cut off of around 20, would require inspection. And there already is a requirement for licensing.
So, Admiral, we were discussing the proposed changes to towing vessels and the increase in number of vessels that will be inspected domestically here. You said that was an additional 7,000 vessels?
Could be up to 7,000, Ben. And, you know, our program now includes around 10,000, so that's a significant increase. But we think this is the right thing to do. We've been actually asked by the American Waterways operators to inspect these vessels. It will provide a constant set of standards that the mariners, and they're all licensed merchant mariners that operate these vessels, that they have for that hull under their feet and the machinery and the safety equipment. I think a lot of them will benefit. We have seen that there is a difference in the number of marine casualties that we experience each year. When you compare the inspected vessels, the Coast Guard inspected and certificated vessels versus the uninspected and not certificated vessels. So this will put the towing vessels in the category with the other commercial vessels.
Yeah, it sounds like it's actually, while it may be a significant workload, it sounds like, as you talk about the accident rate between inspected versus non-inspected vessels, it sounds like this will really be just ultimately make things safer for, you know, for everybody that's working on the water. And if I have to be towed by a vessel, it'll be good to know that you know, that inspection has taken place and there's a minimum standard. So that it's a good thing all the way around.
Right. In the world maritime, I've been very busy with the piracy issue. I'm the co-chair of working group 3 of a UN contact group, and they have an upcoming meeting in London in early September that will be followed immediately by a maritime safety committee meeting of the IMO. And there's a lot of synergy between these two groups because the contact group has been very active across the entire spectrum of issues that cause piracy and that piracy is having on the maritime transportation system, and not just from the perspective of the seafarers that end up hostages, but also in the cost of shipping through that area of the world. So the work group 3 is the one that focuses on the relationship between the governments of the world and the industry itself. And the primary tool there are the best management practices that have been developed.
Yeah.
So we hope in this next meeting to get consensus on the universal application of those best management practices, and then some discussion on this controversial issue of armed private security that would provide some means to fend off pirates from their attacks on ships while they're actually transiting those high-risk waters around Somalia.
Well, it's interesting that I'm glad that you brought that the piracy matter up. I was just reading a piece today. I don't remember which maritime publication it was in, but apparently there was an attack on a vessel either at Anchorage or in port in Oman. So the pirates seem to be, you know, testing new models of operation or business models, as it were. We know that they've hijacked a pleasure craft and sadly killed Americans. Their reach seems to be expanding in the Indian Ocean, and now it appears as if they've attacked a vessel that was in port. So certainly a timely and important matter, and you know, the Coast Guard is involved in the piracy fight. We've discussed it before, and I believe we still may have some law enforcement detachments or at least some Coast Guard officers out in that area, don't we, sir?
Oh, we do. Not enough to actually provide a means to fend off pirates from every single ship, but there is a combined fleet of in navies, ships from all sorts of navies in the country, in the world, and Coast Guard members are embarked on the U.S. portion of that coalition. But I think the most promising way forward is to actually have some form of capable security on each ship. And that's what this private security guard concept is all about. And it's growing in popularity amongst the owners of some of the ships in the that transit those waters. But it's still controversial among a lot of the operators and owners. So we'll see how that progresses. And in the meantime, I'd like to mention, because it is important for seafarers worldwide, that we really also have quite a program here and under my direction in this department in Coast Guard headquarters that focuses on port security. We have an international port security program where we've sent small teams, just two or three Coast Guard officers, to a large percentage of the world's seaports in an effort to verify compliance with the International Port Security Code, which requires some form of security on the part of those port nations, that is largely intended to assist seafarers when they're using the seaports of the world. And then domestically, we've had a program for a number of years to enhance the security in our own ports. And we just had our secretary announce the award of grants for that program just yesterday. And this year's total amount was about $235 million, just for the U.S. ports. So a lot of money has been spent worldwide, I think, on providing safer, more secure infrastructure for seafaring and for the marine transportation system, starting at the port facilities and then moving out into the high seas and into the high-risk waters with these initiatives like the Work Group 3 and the best management practices.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've had an opportunity here at Amver to work with the International Port Security Liaison Program, not from a security standpoint, but because we have Coast Guard representatives literally throughout the world, like you mentioned. And we'll work closely with them as they're going through their daily duties of ensuring that the port facility is secure and dealing with agents or charters or the ship's crew or really anybody that may have a question or a concern about security. They're also kind enough to mention the Amver system, or perhaps if there's been a rescue and a ship is coming into a foreign port, we've got Coast Guard people there that will go and recognize the crew. So I have a very, very fond, strong relationship with the International Port Security Liaison Program, and I'm sure most of our listeners would be surprised to learn that we've got so many people out, Coast Guard people around the world helping. And if perhaps somebody needs to contact the Coast Guard and they're at a major international port, they could probably ask around, and there's a Coast Guard representative there that can answer questions for them or help them out.
Absolutely. We are really proud of those folks. They're doing great work, and their mission is quite literally to outreach and try to focus the world's attention on the things that can be done to make the seafaring and the cargo operations more secure. So the last thing I'd like to mention is has a little bit to do with an environmental, actually a lot to do with environmental. Huge interest in what's going on up in Alaska with regard to oil exploration, and we're working with some of the large companies there that have the potential to do exploration in the fairly near future. That also ties into the investigation report, which will be coming out very shortly from the Deepwater Horizon incident, which has really spawned a whole new industry for well containment, mm-hmm. Which we're starting to see new vessel designs and response methodologies. It's kind of a fascinating new area that kind of reminds me of some of the things that came out of the Exxon Valdez incident. So there's a lot of work amongst our naval architects in the Coast Guard, as well as our policy folks, and a very tight relationship is sprung up between the U.S. Coast Guard and the bureau responsible for giving leases to companies to drill anywhere in the coastal economic zone of the United States, which of course includes the North Slope, just like it does in the Gulf of Mexico and off of California and so on.
Well, and I know the Arctic Council, and which deals with any kind of activity in the Arctic, at least from the shipping side, is interested in interested in the Deepwater Horizon report for the implications it may have in exploration and exploiting energy that's in the Arctic region. So the Arctic Council and our Arctic international partners are interested to see the results of that. I believe the Flag State has come out with a report as well, so there's a lot of information coming out about Deepwater Horizon and the and environmental impacts of shipping and things all around the world right now, more than just the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, I'm sure there's going to be plenty to keep us busy in that area of our responsibilities for a long time. And, these investigations, unfortunately, keep a fair number of our staff very busy, not just here in headquarters, but out in all of our field units as well. There's always lessons learned from these things, and our mission here is to try to do the prevention, try not to make the same mistakes twice. So that's a sort of a recap of what we do here in the Coast Guard Prevention Directorate, and I look forward to giving you more details as it goes along, Ben.
I appreciate it, Admiral. I thank you for your time. In a perfect world, if our prevention worked, our amphor ships wouldn't have to be rescuing mariners. We wouldn't have environmental catastrophes. And we'll keep working on the prevention side of things. And we'll lean to you for more input. And hopefully, we won't have to respond as much. But our amphor ships are ready, and our Coast Guard responders are ready. And we know that sadly, tomorrow there will be another call for assistance. But, Admiral, thank you. It's good to have you back, and I look forward to catching up with you again next month for another edition of the Quarterdeck.
We'll see you then, Ben.
You have been listening to the Quarterdeck. Learn more about the Amber program at amber.com. The Quarterdeck theme song is called Botany Bay by the Blackguards, available at musicalley.com, or follow the link in our show notes.
I'm on the way down to the quay where the good ship and anchor lays, to command the gang of navvies they told me to engage. Well, I thought I'd stop in for a pint before I went away, but I take a trip on an emigrant ship to the shores of...